Hi, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of Season 2 of We Intend to Move On Your Works, a podcast about gaming, the American Civil War, brought to you by Homo Ludens, the channel on board games and history. My name is Alexandre Fontaine-Rousseau, and I'll be facilitating this discussion between Stuart Ellis-Gorman and Pierre Wagner-Jones. Hi, guys.
Hiya.
Oh.
So, Season 2, how are we feeling? No regrets, no grudges, no animosity towards each other, just good times, nice, wholesome fun, yeah. Going through the U.S. Civil War in chronological order.
No regrets and no grudges.
No more grudges than we started with.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm still losing most of the games I play, but you know.
You did pretty well this time, though.
I did very well this time. Pretty well. Come on, I won every game, didn't I?
Yeah, you lost the middle one.
That's not what I remember, but I'll have to listen to all of the episodes of season one to know that for sure. So we do love acronyms in the wonderful wargaming world. And so after dabbling in GBACW with Into the Woods, you guys went for another big one, which is GCACW, which stands for Great Campaigns of the American Civil War. And this is a bit of a change of pace for you both, or rather a change of scale, because we are now zooming out and looking at the conflict from an operational perspective. This system, as its name implies, models campaigns rather than specific battles. And the one you've played, which is Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 by Joe Barkovsky, focuses on the Northern Virginia campaign. And this leads us into what I honestly enjoy the most about these little discussions of ours, which is a history lesson from Stuart, because to be honest, I don't know much about the Northern Virginia campaign apart from the fact that we've covered quite a few of these battles in the previous episodes of the podcast. So Stuart, why don't you give us a little summary of what is being covered by Stonewall Jackson's Way 2?
Sure. So we're moving back east now after our kind of time in Shiloh. We've gone east now, so if people remember where we finished up last time when we were in the east was with the Seven Days Battles, which were when Robert E. Lee led a series of attacks that eventually drove McClellan's Army of the Potomac from outside Richmond east to the coast of Virginia. That happened over the summer of 1862, and following this defeat in June 1862, Lincoln created a new army, which was called the Army of Virginia, to be led by General John Pope. Pope had served in the Western Theater. He'd initially served in Missouri as an officer, then along the Mississippi, and eventually was a participant in the capture of Corinth, which is a big victory that follows on from Shiloh, where the Union Army marches south into Corinth, Mississippi, which is a major rail junction. It was the initial target of that Shiloh invasion, except that the Confederates attacked them before they could march south. So following these kind of victories, he was closely connected with General Halleck, who had been in charge in the Western Theater, and General Halleck was brought in by Lincoln during the 7 days. When McClellan went to the peninsula, Lincoln had Halleck replace McClellan as the overall commander of the army, arguing that basically while McClellan was in the field, he couldn't also be commanding the overall armed forces. It also, Lincoln didn't like McClellan very much, so it was a little bit of a subtle way to get him out of having both of these positions. The Army of Virginia was created using soldiers that had mostly been stationed in the Shenandoah Valley or in Northern Virginia, so it was merging several units that had kind of been under various disparate categories. So it included units under the command of General McDowell, who we might remember from First Bull Run or Manassas, General Nathaniel Banks, who showed up in the Valley Campaign, and General Fremont, who was also in the Valley Campaign, although Fremont really hated Pope and would actually resign eventually rather than serve in the army. To further reinforce this army, three corps from McClellan's Army of the Potomac were eventually assigned to the Army of Virginia. Those corps would be sailed up the Chesapeake Bay and brought into Washington. A kind of thing to note here that comes up in some histories or accounts of the history of these armies, there's a tendency to emphasize changes in command within the Union Army in the Eastern Theater, and some accounts will describe Pope as taking over from McClellan in command. So McClellan being fired, replaced, and then coming back later, because McClellan will come into command again and be in command for the rest of the campaign that follows from this. But actually, this is a new army that was made specifically for this purpose. It doesn't last very long, so it is kind of in a weird space, and we'll talk about that in a second. But just to clarify, that Pope is not in command of the Army of the Potomac, which is kind of a mistake you see crop up sometimes in people's understanding of this. Pope really did not endear himself to his men to begin with. He opened with this kind of famous speech that he gave all of his men, and one of the opening lines of it was, "I have come to you from the West, where we have always seen the backs of our enemies, from an army whose business it has been to seek the adversary and to beat him when he was found, whose policy has been attack and not defense." And he went on for about another paragraph there. So you can imagine that these armies fighting in Virginia didn't take too kindly to this guy. And to note, like, Pope was not an amazing general in the West. You know, this was not Grant coming east. So it was a bit galling, and they did not appreciate that. And so it set off not a good relationship with the men under his command.
I wouldn't ask so.
He sucks. So instead of, so initially the plan was, they thought was maybe that he would wait for the rest of McClellan's army to come up to Northern Virginia, and then they would attack down. But instead, Pope decides to attack while McClellan's army is still in transit. He marched south on the 29th of July, going into Virginia to take the offensive against Lee. Nathaniel Banks, who was leading the 2nd Corps of the Army of Virginia, took up a position on Cedar Mountain, from which he could raid nearby Confederate positions. And then the 9th of August, Stonewall Jackson attacked him there at the Battle of Cedar Mountain, delivering a severe defeat to Banks and driving the Union from that position. Lee then sent Longstreet to follow up and reinforce Jackson the next following week on the 13th, around the 13th of August, and began planning a campaign to try and attack Pope before McClellan could join up and they could unite their forces into one larger army. Pope withdrew behind the Rappahannock River over the 20th and 21st of August, and they skirmished around the river for a few days, and eventually, on 26th of August, Jackson marched kind of all around the western flank and came in through the mountains to flank Pope from the west, striking at Union supplies and train stations. So then Pope thought he could get Jackson, now that Jackson was basically behind his lines, and isolate him. Between the 28th and the 30th of August, near Manassas, which means this battle is the second battle, the second Manassas or second Bull Run, Pope set about attacking Jackson, but his intelligence was poor, whether due to lack of scouting or just lack of caring on his part, and he was not aware that the rest of Lee's army was quite close behind, and so he was almost completely encircled and attacked by Longstreet on his other flank and delivered a crushing defeat, caused the Union army to retreat back across Bull Run, in good order at least, so he didn't lose the whole army, but it was a very bad defeat, and they basically were trapped in Washington at that point. The Army of Virginia was officially disbanded on the 12th of September, and all of its units were then absorbed into the Army of the Potomac. McClellan was in command of that army, so basically he gained back his 3 corps that had gone to the Army of Virginia, and then the other corps that had been in the Army of Virginia. Pope was transferred to Minnesota, where he fought in the Dakota Wars in 1862, which is an interesting reminder that throughout the American Civil War, there are these kind of Western wars with Native tribes ongoing. There's the Dakota Wars in are now the Dakotas, and then there are several wars kind of other places in the West. So that kind of ongoing colonial genocide thing is a project that is not just a post-Civil War thing, it's a during the Civil War thing as well. Mm. So Lee's victory at Second Bull Run, and is effectively pushing the army back into Washington, would then set the stage for his first invasion of the North and his Maryland campaign. We'll get to the Maryland campaign, but like at this point, he actually has full control of Virginia, and he's planning what to do with that.
I appreciate the fact that, like, I started this podcast series, like, not knowing any of those names. And by now I'm just like, oh, yeah, I know of these people. Yeah, I know. So let's get back to the game itself, though. First thing I'd like to hear about is the scale. Because as I said earlier, this plays at the operational level, and that's a big change from what you'd previously played. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the game itself, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the feel of the system and the way that it represents conflict at this scale. Like, does the scale work for you?
I think for me, it works pretty well. It's the scale is divisions and brigades with some corps leaders. And I think it works pretty well for me. It really emphasizes the importance of maneuver. And but it's still like, so it's zoomed out quite a bit. You know, you can see quite a lot of armies all over, sort of being able to maneuver each other, and a small like a battle will be over a couple of hexes rather than splayed out over a long line. But you don't sort of get lost, you don't get too lost. Like, you can really see the detail in the terrain as well, so you can make meaningful decisions with the maneuver and everything. I mean, especially when it comes to terrain features like rivers, I think that's maybe the most impactful thing on this. I think if the scale was zoomed out a bit more, you would have to lose that just by necessity. But it's right at that sort of sweet spot where you can still have battles and they still feel like they're important. You still feel like you're not losing anything by wanting to simulate battles, but you can also focus on the maneuver. And that's really the name of the game, I think, with like the day by day. I think each turn is one day. I don't know if that's different with any of the other entries. But each
turn is a day is default in the system. And I really like that about it, because it makes the tempo very understandable.
Exactly.
How far can you push your men in a day?
Exactly. And it's very, like, it's impossible to have two battles for the same unit in a day unless they've been caught, you know, unless they've, like, been forced to retreat and then caught by another army. So it really makes it sort of, each day is very, like, each move is very impactful, and you can really feel that you're pushing your units, if that makes sense. Like, I guess this is maybe like going over to another subject we're going to go over, but like the fatigue system marries really well with the operational system, where every time you activate a unit or a general and you activate the general's units, you know, all of them at once, they take a point of fatigue no matter what. And
that's really interesting.
It's really interesting. And I think the maximum is 4 points of fatigue, or is it 3 points? Yeah, it's 4 points of fatigue. And
you only get three back turn to turn, though. So if you go to four, you'll retain one the next turn.
Exactly. So that really lets you, if you want, sprint across a road. You know, like you really need to get over this river, and you really want to like surprise the enemy by making a really ballsy play. Or you can play it safe and make sure you have fatigue next time. You know, you might be able to like skirmish a little bit, but not commit too much. What about you, Stuart? And I think maybe we can talk about the movement system as well.
I like it a lot. I think it's really interesting. And as you say, the movement and the kind of tempo of the game is really interesting, where you're, how much can you push? How far can you push them? And then if you're playing over many, many turns, there might be that you push for several turns and then you need a turn to recover. Because also, if you go up to three or four fatigue, your units become exhausted the next day. And exhausted units then, if you go to the higher fatigue levels, you have to roll to see if you suffer attrition, basically. Or if you become disorganized first, and then if you suffer attrition, and being disorganized reduces your fighting power. And you can only recover from being disorganized if your fatigue is low at the end of a day.
Yeah.
So these kind of managing things, if you become exhausted, then you're going to have to roll on the attrition table more often. So you do kind of have a bit of a balance of like, okay, do I push really hard this turn? And then do I have time to rest for another turn? And then can I push these units and rest these units? And how do I manage this over the course of several days? And then that's also the other twist in that, is that the game is roll and move. So you activate a unit to move, by default you're going to roll a d6 and they're going to move that far in hex, or in, they have that many movement points. If you move along a road, it's only one movement point as long as it's not raining. So it can be that many hexes on a road. Mm-hmm. Going off-road becomes very difficult very quickly. Mm-hmm. The minimum movement points off-road, I think, is 3 movement points.
Yeah.
So it becomes really challenging, and it just goes up from there. And then if you're activated with a general, you get plus one movement point. If you're the Confederates, you get plus one movement point, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. And cavalry go 2d6. Combat, initiating a combat can be a form of movement, where you spend movement points to initiate combat against an enemy hex if you're doing one counterattacking into one hex. So there's all these kind of factors to consider about, like, how far can you move? And, like, sometimes if you've done two activations, you didn't want to push your unit, and you activate them once, and they move one hex. Then you activate them again, and they move, like, two hexes. And now you're like, oh, I really hoped that we were going to get, like, five hexes and that we were going to rest. But now it's like, do I push them? Does that make sense? So that randomness is really interesting, and really then feeds into the whole game's feel and flow, which is engaging.
I think on that, it really encourages you, before you even start playing the game, to have a good look at the map and recognize where the main arteries are for the roads, and where the main roadblocks will be in the form of rivers or maybe rough terrain, where the enemy might want to sort of set up their troops as a defensive position. I think that's really interesting. I mean, something Stuart and I really enjoy, I think, in games, is that approach to battle, in grand tactical games at least. But like in this, obviously it's operational, but you really do get that feel. Where I had units starting quite literally on the other side of the map, and at the beginning I'm just like, oh, these guys are going to be entirely irrelevant, you know, like I do not need to worry about these guys. But eventually I did have to like bring them in, and slowly bring them in, and choose which sort of direction I need to commit to, because if I commit going directly west with my guys that start sort of near Fredericksburg, is that right? Yeah, or just north of Fredericksburg, if I go directly west, Stuart's troops might sort of head northeast and make that sort of loop be forced by me, whereas if I sort of get going directly north of myself, I can cut them off when they're going northeast, you know, and I really need to decide that early. And it really leads to really interesting decisions, I think, which is nice. And without too much rules weight behind it, I find. That whole movement system is pretty straightforward.
Activating and moving is really clean.
Yeah.
Yeah, because yeah. I was going to say that from an outsider perspective, I think the general feeling is that this is a pretty complex system. And
absolutely.
Having played it, would you validate that impression, or is GCACW more accessible than one might think?
So for me, and I think Stuart was the one who was teaching it to me, we both have a copy. I've got Stonewall Jackson's Way, and he's got, which one have you got, Stuart?
Stonewall in the Valley.
Yeah. So we both had like the rule books of the older versions. So I read through that, but obviously we were playing Stonewall Jackson's Way 2. I was being taught it and I found it really smooth. I really didn't find it that heavy of a system. It's got these little quirks. It's got a lot of chrome, but it's all pretty, like, when you have the rulebook up, it's pretty self-explanatory. It reads pretty easily. I think the one thing that tripped us up were the flanking rules in combat, that we had to look them up each
flanking
time.
Flanking rules and the entrenching rules were also a little bit...
They were, and I think that's partially because we were playing on Vassal the entire time, and that was automated, so we didn't understand why that was happening, rather, and we were like, what is this? Let's set it to this.
I also don't think it's... That's probably the worst part of the rulebook, I think, because it how entrenching works differs by what year of the war you're in.
Yeah.
So there's because, and that's true to the history, like, entrenching became more sophisticated and more important in 64 and 65. But I don't think it's laid out very well for that. Yeah. I think the way it's structured is just too confusing. It kind of, it teaches you all of these systems, and then it's like, but only use this part for this and stuff. And I think I think there's a better way to have laid it out.
Yeah.
I think it's not very coherent, and that part can be quite tricky, in particular, like, figuring out, like, okay, wait, does this rule is only in 1863, but we're in 62. Yeah. Oh, but this part does still apply. Mm. And
but once you've got that
was a bit fiddly.
Once you got that down, though, it's fine. And I mean, I
the core of it is...
Yeah, go ahead.
I would say it's not more complicated than Blind Swords was.
Definitely not, yeah. Mm. And I think the game series I'd compare it to the most would be The Library of Napoleonic Battles. And I think that series is lauded quite often as being pretty accessible. Like, not simple, but sort of mid-weight for a war game. And I think this is more accessible than that.
I would say for Stonewall Jackson's Way 2, for the advanced games, there's a basic and an advanced game.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
The advanced game... So this is all basic game. The advanced game of Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 is barely more complicated. It's only got a few more rules.
Yeah.
It's like maybe 10 pages of extra rules, and most of that is detachments, which you don't even really need to use. I will say that, like, there are other entries in the game, like the On to Richmond 2, which is the most recent one that came out. That one has, if you go into the advanced game, has a lot more game-specific rules. There's a lot more rules governing how McClellan activates and how certain aspects of the peninsula work. So some of the games, when you get to the advanced game, you could be adding 20 to 30 more pages of rules. Mm. Versus Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 is very much on the simpler end of that. And there are ones that are much simpler on that end. So I think there's probably a bigger complexity variance in advanced games from entry to entry. But certainly the basic game is very much more approachable than I anticipated. It's very midweight, I would say. It's not too complicated, but also... Maybe not baby's first war game.
No. Yeah, definitely not.
But would you say the extra weight of the advanced game is worth that effort? Like, does it add enough for it to be worthy, or should people be fine with playing the basic version if they want to?
I think the advanced game goes hand in hand with the longer scenarios, and I think that's where this game shines. So the interesting stuff about this game is the supply, is the long-term management of your fatigue, that sort of thing. And what's fatigue obviously is in the basic game. The supply is something, I believe, that comes into play more in the advanced game. And you really need to have that in mind whilst you're going along. And I think that it's because it's a long game, you're likely not going to finish a long game in one evening. I always feel that takes off the rules weight a little bit, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not going to be moment-to-moment gameplay where you have to have everything in your head at once. You can really sit back, be like, okay, we're finishing this turn. Next turn is the supply turn. We're going to have to worry about that. Let's have a quick look, you know?
You sort of know what you're in for.
Exactly, man. Exactly. What do you think, Stuart? Because obviously I'm saying this from the perspective of having been taught the game, but rather than learning it.
The basic game has a lot to offer, mm-hmm. honestly. And I will say one thing about GCACW, and this, I did not expect this to be true. This is the first game we've played where we finished an entire game in one evening.
Yeah. Insane.
The entire podcast. We've never had one evening to finish a game. We finished two. We did the first two games we played were both one evening each. The basic scenarios we played. So the basic scenarios, like a lot of them, you could be playing that 1 to 3 hours.
Yeah.
Like really quite short. And that could be a couple of turns. And I would say they kind of lean a bit more towards almost a puzzle. So it'll be like the first one we played was that the Confederates have to take Culpeper and they have two turns to do it. That's quite a tight time frame, and you have to go this distance and figure out how to take it and get a few victory points and drive the Union off. And so it's a very tight puzzle of a game for you to play, but you can play it really easily in an evening. And that is an interesting experience in its own right. And then the advanced game is when you get into these more, it's more of a campaign
exactly
at that point. Yeah. And you're playing for that longer game. And even the Stonewall Jackson's campaigns are, the short one we played is 8 turns. The longer one's only 15 turns. You know, there are, I think the Stonewall in the Valley campaign is like 90 turns. So there's a real, they can get really long. But when we play, this would be 3 evenings really. And less if you play for more hours than we do in
evening. Yeah, we play usually for 2 to 3 hours, I think, per evening because of work. Yeah. And also you've got your kid and stuff like that. We usually stream it on the Homebrew Dens Discord server on Monday evenings. But it's so accessible, I think. It's so quick to play with the short scenarios. And I think the longer scenarios, hearing like a 90-turn scenario, I think with other games, like maybe previous games we've mentioned, like Into the Woods maybe, other big games, you know, I would see that and I would say, oh, this is going to take that long. I'm out, you know, I'm not going to do that. Whereas this, these big scenarios, they sort of tell me, oh, I do want to try that. I want to get really into it over a weekend or something, you know.
And yeah.
I think one of the promises of that big scenario in this is that every moment feels like it will be interesting.
Mm.
Every action, because sometimes when you see like a big game with a lot of rules, it's like, okay, yeah, but the first 4 turns are just the setup to the real game, you know, where it's like we're gonna not do a whole lot, and then eventually, like the game, it's real. Like the game gets good around hour 20, you know,
unless you fuck up at hour 14.
Slow burn. It's amazing because it's a slow burn.
But like GCACW has that like grand length, but I also feel like it has that instant moment of excitement. It's like, you know, playing a Civilization, you know, where it's like each turn has that little granular excitement, and then you also have your medium turn goals, and those are exciting. And then
I do,
you know, if this was like a video game, you could absolutely get sucked into one more turn of it.
I think this is really cliche, and it's been done with a lot of war games by, I think, incorrectly a lot of times, and I think this is maybe a bit facetious or incorrect, but I would compare it a little bit to chess, where like every move matters and you can really think tactically each time. You know, you're thinking on that level rather than, I don't know, one of my favorite war games is Men of Iron. You know, it's completely different to this. But a lot of the time, I'm not thinking what's the optimal move I'm doing here. I'm just sort of charging and smashing in and seeing what the emergent narrative is from there. Whereas I do feel more like a general being like, I need to poke on his right flank a little bit and then circle around here and really hope that my lines of communication hold to get, you know, like the narrative is that when I'm really just hoping for a high roll for my movement. And I really, you know, you can really get into your head like that and really sort of have that moment to moment, really important decisions every single turn, multiple times a turn as well.
Yeah, which is a consequence of the scale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly, Alexandre.
So Stuart, I know you played this solo using a physical copy of the game, and then you played it through Vassal against Pierre. And from what I gather, you actually enjoyed playing this one in the digital format for practical reasons?
Yes. So I played a bit of Stonewall in the Valley solo, kind of try and wrap my head around the system before I was going to play it with Pierre. And the thing, I find it quite difficult in physical play. And a big part of that is the stacking and the manipulation of counters. So we say you add a fatigue every time you do something. A fatigue is a counter that goes under your unit. So you've got, you know, two types of fatigue counter, and you're going to be flipping them. So every time you activate a unit, you got to pick the counter up and flip the fatigue around or switch a new fatigue in. Then strength is also tracked on a separate counter that's going to go under your unit counter. So you're going to have to like update strength and have strength. So basically every unit is going to be 3 counters almost all the time. And they're half inch counters. And then there's no stacking limit. And if you're going to have more units in a single hex, then that's going to go higher and higher. Generals sit on top of units. So they could be, and you could have a core general and then an army general on top of him in a hex. You could have a single unit be 5 counters. I am a very low dexterity individual, so manipulating big stacks of counters is not my strong suit. And like anything over 3 is pretty horrible for me. So I found that very difficult. And there's a lot of bookkeeping, because then at the end of every turn, you got to go around and update all the fatigues and remember who's exhausted and figure out who's disorganized and what fatigue were they on. Oh, you can also become demoralized or entrenched, which are 2 more counters you can add on to any single unit. Versus the Vassal mod just does all of that in hand. Like the people who've made it have made an amazing product.
It's like magic. Yeah.
You hit the end of turn button and it does all of the updating for you. It flips over people to exhausted. It reorganizes units. It's amazing. And they track the fatigue by a little color on the unit. The manpower strength is on the unit. It's really clean on Vassal in a way that it feels very old in the in-person games.
I think in person, if you're dedicating a whole weekend to it, doing one of the big games, I can see the appeal and I'd like to play it. And I think I'd like to play it despite the physical weirdness of it, because I set up the shortest scenario that we did solo. I set it up on the table because I have Stonewall Jackson's Way 1, and I just didn't play it because I was looking at it and I was like, this isn't a fun solo experience for me, because it's more admin, because your decisions are going to be taking are much quicker than the actual admin at the end of the turn it takes, and that's just not fun for me. I completely get the appeal. 100% I get the appeal. And I think a lot of people love getting in the weeds there, like managing the stacks. And that adds to the narrative a lot, because you feel like maybe that operational supply aspect is maybe more emphasized when you really have to be careful of your stacks and know how much like fatigue each stack has and whatever. I get it. It's just really not for me. It's exactly what Stuart said. It feels old. And I think other people have said that the newer entries by MMP include those off-map boxes.
They include a generic forces one, so you can put a forces one in. They don't include, like, some people have made their own sheets for where it has each of the units.
Oh,
and
then
you can track the fatigue on a side sheet. So it'll say, like, you know, this is Sickle's unit or whatever, and it'll have boxes for you to put the fatigue and the strength in it.
I mean,
and so then you can just have his counter on the map and move it around. So people have done their own ones of those.
But then... that's exactly what you do with Manassas, the first game we played in the podcast. And that's from 1980. You know, like it's antiquated. And it was cute then, I think, because everything was hand-drawn. But I think that there must be a better solution.
It feels like they could have come up with a better solution.
It really, really does.
Particularly for how much these games cost.
Jesus Christ.
It's a certain type of brain burning that some people are attuned to.
Yeah, I get the appeal.
It gets the juices going and the brain cell burning. And it
saves off the dementia. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll have to ask, how does one go about winning a game of Stonewall Jackson's Way 2? What are the victory conditions in this one?
Points, baby!
And how would you say they affect the flow of play and the narrative arc of the game? Points, sure, but what points?
It's all points, all the way down. Yeah. But yeah, Stuart can rag on this.
I hate it. I hate it so much. This is like the antithesis of what I like in a victory system for a war game. It's all victory points, and I baseline don't love victory points in war games. I think it's too abstract.
Especially Hex and Counter War games.
Especially Hex and Counter War games. I can tolerate a certain amount of it if it's kind of very clear what they are and stuff, but like even the basic scenario for this had like 9 victory point categories. And it's stuff like, if you control Culpepper, you get X points, except if there's a Union unit next to it, then you get Y points. And then you get points for doing this and points for doing that. And for every manpower unit, you get points. And if you route them, you get points, and then you get points for doing this. And it's like, I kind of see what's happening. It's clearly a very intensely playtested game. I fully believe that they're very balanced as a result, and they want to give you options. Like, it isn't trying to really railroad you in the way, like, when I complain about Longstreet Attacks, how it felt like it was forcing you along a historical path. When we played the big campaign, there was, like, 30 victory point options or something, and, like, they're all over the map. So there's different paths to victory, in a way, but it just felt very tiresome to have to remember them all and keep trying to track them. And, again, the Vassal modules help. They highlight the hexes that you have to, like, destroy these stations or do this or that, but it's too much. And I remember specifically our second game, and this is why I remember that I won it. It's because Pierre passed, and it was the last turn, and I spent like 4 minutes calculating my victory points, and then when I figured out I had won, I passed and ended the game.
Yeah,
and that's a thing I hate doing in Euro games.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, it's like sounds like a Euro game
figuring that out,
and it sounds like a point styled Euro too.
Exactly.
The worst kind of Euro endgame ever.
It turns into a zero-sum game where you're just mathing it out. And it's just, it gets rid of the narrative so much.
That's bad.
That's
really bad.
It doesn't even flavor them, you know, like at least with, I'll mention Men of Iron, a completely unrelated Hex Encounter game.
Which you seem to enjoy quite a bit, but...
you know, I enjoy it. But like, they call it flight points, you know? At least you got that of it, you know, when you kill units and stuff. And that's using points, but at least that makes it a bit interesting and adds it into the narrative. Here, it's quite literally victory points. And you can't track them either, can you? Because obviously you have the cities, but like the amount of men that you've routed.
Yeah, the routed one is really annoying.
There's no aid to help you with that.
How many routes did I trigger this turn? And did I remember them all? And then like you have to remember how many manpower losses you did, but at least you can check against starting strength, but you have to look in the scenario booklet to check what the starting strength is because it's not on the counters.
Yeah.
And then there was like, if I triggered Union Panic, I got victory points. There's a few of those like conditional ones. And I think that struck me as well was when we were talking to Arno and some of the people on the Discord who played a lot more of this about the manpower losses, he'd be like, yeah, but most of the games, it just kind of cancels out and there's not that many victory points in it. Yeah. It's like, but then why am I doing it? You know, like, because it is like for the campaign for the Confederates, I had to get to like 45 victory points. And it's like, is a difference of like 3 points in how often is that like a couple of casualties on a big campaign going to matter? And then if it's not really going to matter, why am I tracking this? Yeah. And realistically, if I lose half, if the other person has twice as many units as me because I'm doing that badly, surely I've lost. You know,
yeah,
like surely the disparity in manpower will have a knock-on effect in the game if it becomes so severe that it would affect the victory. It just feels like there's some of them where it's like this I would actually, and because I care less about balance, I would prefer to rip out a bunch of this stuff for a simpler victory condition that might be slightly less finely tuned.
And I think you've touched on it, but this all comes down to balance, and I think this is the most balanced game, like war game, that I've ever played. I think, bar none. It's so like you've touched on it again, Stuart, but you can tell it's been really extensively playtested, really, really well, and each scenario has really been looked at, has been really tweaked, you know, whilst keeping those historical deployments. And I think there's a lot to be said about that. It's not, again, I agree with Stuart, it's not my favorite way of doing things. I prefer when it's sort of more honestly portraying, I don't know, this is pretentious, but like honestly portraying the history without maybe caring for balance to show, and the interesting thing is playing it out, you know. But I really get the appeal of going for that balance, and maybe victory points are not the easiest answer, but are maybe the most effective answer to show that sort of thing. Because I don't know how you can fix it, really. If you're going for small scenarios to be this intricately balanced, I think it's quite hard to sort of determine a winner without going for that sort of thing. But I don't know. It's
so you've mostly gushed about this system so far. I'm really interested in it. Sounds amazing. I guess I'll buy one of these games. Oh my, what are these prices? And why are they all out of print and going for crazy prices on the secondary market? Oh no. Oh no. I mean, we know war games are expensive, but these specific games are something else, really.
Yeah, it's something else. And if you want to buy it outside of North America, that's another,
and even the United States, honestly, at this point, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a lot. I mean, it's so much money. How much is Onto Richmond? I'm not sure how much Onto Richmond is. I think
something.
It's above £200 at least, and that's just.
And is it still available?
So it's available in the UK, but I have no idea whether it's out of print in the US. But I know that Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 is out of print.
Yeah,
and I think it came out and it was less than that. It was $150, something
like
that.
$120 when it came out.
$120, but try and get it secondhand.
Be hard pressed to get it for less than $150 and probably $200. And there's not that many on the market.
And that's insane to me. I think it's go ahead.
I was going to say at this point, it sort of feels like the MMP business model.
It does. Like, it's exclusivity. Like, it's
OCS is that too. And
exactly. I think the main, I guess, excuse. I don't want to say this is an excuse. And wargaming is a really tough business. Publishing is a really tough business, especially now with the cost of everything going up. That said, these prices have been like this since forever. But I think it's because they're printed in the US. I think that has a big impact on it. And that's really good that they're printing it domestically.
Yeah.
Just from like an environmental point of view. Like, it's way better to do that than having to ship things from China all the time. Like, props to them for doing that. And I get it. These games are great. There's a lot of content in them. I think a lot of people excuse the price for the content. I think that's bullshit, personally. I've played so many games, hex and counter games, with way more content than these for less than half the price. I think it's maybe reflecting the playtesting. It's maybe reflecting the design work that comes in. But I think that's maybe minimizing other games. Unless MMP have the best paid designers in the business, which I doubt they do. I think they're probably on par with every other main publisher. I don't know.
Maybe the smaller print runs also explain something. Like,
maybe, but then why the small print runs? There's clearly a huge demand for these. I'll need to look it up now. I don't have it on my screen, but I think just, and this isn't this doesn't show everything, but I think Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 has over 200, 300 reviews. It's in the top 100, is that right, war games?
It is 330 reviews. It's the 82nd ranked war game on BGG.
There you go. And it's what, like 8.6 out of 10 on BGG? 8.7 out of 10. It's really well received. It's a popular thing. Everyone I've heard talk about it gushes about it. I think it could sell more.
I think it's pretty. I think the biggest barrier to entry is that availability issue.
I'm never going to buy one of these, ever.
Yeah. I mean, because when we talked about how it's much less complicated to play than people think, that I think makes it accessible. And I think the difficulty is buying a game in the series. And in particular, like something like Onto Richmond has come out and it's like €250 and huge amounts of campaign. And it's a way more complicated entry in the series.
Yeah.
So it's not a great point to get on board versus Stonewall Jackson's Way 2 is a great entry point into the game. It's much simpler. Much easier to get, yeah. Except like, where are you going to buy it? It's insanely expensive and out of print, and who knows if they'll print it again. I mean, I think they have reprinted it at least once. Something like, I know Battle Above the Clouds, which came out ages ago. It's so long ago that actually the listed price is less than $100, but it hasn't been in print for like 10 years. So some of them don't get reprinted at all, and I think there's a certain like scarcity fear in MMP games that like they'll print a game and they'll never reprint it, so you got to buy it now, kind of FOMO element to a lot of their games. Yeah. Even something like Hood Strikes North, which is the one mapper kind of entry game that's out right now, is $100. You know, so it's very hard to just dip your toe into GCACW.
And these are paper maps, you know, like
it's one map and two counter sheets. That I think is one of the most egregiously overpriced. Like that's such a insane price for that. But I think to a degree, it's a lifestyle game. It's targeted at people who are already fans. They know they have those fans, and they aren't necessarily looking. I mean, they are happy that other people find it, but aren't necessarily looking to market a broad audience for these games.
Yeah. I think I mean, they could... MMP don't market anything ever. Yeah. So, yeah
I think on. It could reach a much wider audience if these were like if Hood Strikes North was like even $70, it would be much easier to kind of justify just trying the system. Now, I will say that they have put their rule books all online and there are the Vassal modules. So if you're prepared to just play digitally and not buy the games, you can do that. You can play pretty much the entire series, certainly of the MMP releases. I actually own Stonewall in the Valley in part because it's not available that way because it was only printed by Avalon Hill. But if you want to play any of the MMP ones, that was a fairly recent thing, I think, done in the last year. They put all the scenarios
really
online.
Good. Like props to them for the scenario booklets as well. That's really, really good from a publisher's point of view, I think. And it's a big risk as well with something so expensive. Like this, this is the only reason I'm playing it, you know, is because I have access to those rules and that online vassal. But then go ahead, Stuart.
I think people would I don't prefer to play games that way. I'll try a game that way, but if I'm going to play it lots, I'd like to own it. And so it feels weird to be like, well, you could just play them all and then not pay anything for them.
It does.
Which you can do, but it feels like a weird recommendation. And I think that's shown by products like Rally the Troops, that like these freely available good implementations then shift copies of the games, is like not true here because you can't buy the game.
Yeah, and I think your point of like if the price point went down 30%, my boy math would make me want to buy three copies of them, you know. But like I don't want to buy one copy here because it's just so expensive. It's I don't know. I think that's a sore spot for me because it's so much more expensive than everything else. I mean, I buy Library of Napoleonic Battles games. Those are expensive. Those don't have many counter sheets. Those are similar in that they have beautiful maps. They often have four or five maps in a box each time. You know, it's one designer, so it's easier.
But... Napoleon and Piedmont is, what, three maps, and it's the same. It's almost the same price as Hood Strikes North.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is one map.
It's £90, I think,
But people don't listen to the podcast for like hot money tips and economics of war games. They listen to this podcast for the hot historical takes, critical views on the representation of history through cardboard and charts. And how does this one fare in that regard? Like, what stance do you think this game takes towards its subject?
Got a big old, that title, the big old Stonewall Jackson's Way as a title.
He did it his way.
It's his way.
There are three games in the series with Stonewall in the title.
Yeah.
Stonewall in the Valley, Stonewall Jackson's Way, and Stonewall's Last Battle.
Yeah. He's the main character.
The hero, if you will.
Yeah, if you will. Our protagonist. That's the main thing for me. Obviously, there's outside of the mechanical things, which we will talk about, it's called Stonewall Jackson's Way too. There's a big picture of Stonewall on the front, all guys in grey uniforms with the big flying Confederate flag. And yes, it's because he did that big flanking maneuver, I think, which won him the second Bull Run. But also this, I don't know, it feels a bit weird. Maybe a picture of the Battle of Bull Run. Like, I don't know.
It's always weird when you slap Stonewall on things, because he is just a pillar of the Lost Cause on his own.
Yeah.
And, you know, framing that, and the same with, like, Stonewall's last battle, you know, the key thing in Chancellorsville is that he dies. Mm. It's like, it's common. It's not like this isn't a, you know, a super out there take or anything. No. I'm not super, because the name is from 1992, but it still feels like a weird, like, not a choice I would have made, I suppose. I think the other thing about it is that it's very much operational, in that what it cares about is the movement of armies.
Yeah.
What it doesn't really care about is the wider implications of any of that.
No.
It has this big section in the back of the rulebook called The Game as History. And The Game as History kind of breaks down, like, what's happening on each turn in the actual campaign, because each turn is a day in the game. So you can do, like, a what happened historically on the 9th of August is like, on the map you're looking at.
Yeah. He's like, he rolled a 6 on this day.
Jackson moved up this road and attacked Pope on this hex, kind of thing. That's interesting. It's cool to have, but it's really devoid of any of the politics of the war or any of the wider implications of the war, even like wider elements that would have affected operational movement. Like, there's no systems in place for, like, the fleeing of slaves to the Union Army, which is a major element, particularly in things like the Peninsula Campaign, but in a lot of campaigns, once slaves found out that they could be made free by getting behind Union lines, that was a pretty common thing to do when the Union marched a huge army into your territory, was to get there. And then that was a huge logistical challenge for the Union, because it was basically like receiving refugees. What happens when you're an army and you receive refugees? You have to house them, you have to clothe them. There's basic needs you have to provide them. And so suddenly this is a logistical element to your supply you have to factor in. It was a huge problem for McClellan in the Peninsula, because that was where the densest slave plantations are in Virginia. So there's none of that element in it. And it's kind of interesting, I think, just because Joe Balkoski, the designer, has tangled with politics and operational games before. His Korean War design, which I own and have not played yet, but it's meant to be absolutely amazing. It's a classic Victory Games from around this era. It was a bit before the GCACW, I think 88, 89. That has entire politics systems built into the UN invasion. So I know he was on War Games to Go and he talked about politics in operational games. So he's clearly something that he's comfortable with, but either wasn't interested in or wasn't comfortable with including in an American Civil War game.
These issues with the slaves sort of coming into and disrupting the supply lines and disrupting maybe the elan of the armies, you know, their surges forwards. That's exactly at this scale as well, you know? Like, this is the scale where that would be represented and where that would have a massive impact. And that's why it feels even weirder for it not to be here. It's not like we're saying, this is a tactical game, you know, and where are the little slave counters fleeing behind the enemy lines? That's not what we're saying. It's that this is where you would see the impact, you know.
And particularly because the slaves are the people pulling all of the, like, driving the Confederate army.
Yeah.
So they also have that risk where, like, what happens if chunks of your army flee to the other side? That is something that they had to think about avoiding.
Yeah. They're the cooks, you know, of the army. They're the people carrying all the ammo.
The Teamsters, they're everywhere. Like, yeah. They're digging all that entrenchment that's happening. That's the slaves, baby. They're digging those pits.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So it was strange that it wasn't there, I think, especially with the context of Joe being a great designer. I mean, there's the obvious thing that people talk about, which is the bonuses that the Confederates have and the malices that the Union has. Sort of across the board in almost every entry. It's that the Confederates are always faster, they always get a bonus to their movement, and the generals, I think certain generals, are always better in battle and get a bonus, which
when they initiate an assault, which is a specific action you can choose to do, where you attack from one hex to an adjacent hex,
and those bonuses are super impactful. I think we were talking to, like, we've mentioned Arno before from the Home Ruler's Discord. He was helping us through some of the games, and he was saying you always want to attack at a +3. You know, +3 is the sort of baseline, because odds wise you're going to get a good result. you get, so every plus is really, really important. Every modifier is so important because that's not a huge difference on the dice, you know. And you get plus one from just being Stonewall Jackson or Lee.
Yeah.
And you get, I think, Stuart, the comparison you meant is that you also get plus one for having 2-1 odds in a battle, you know, numerical odds. And that's insane when you frame it like that.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Absolutely.
That's really weird, and that's a choice. The game is balanced. That's a choice, you know.
And on top of that, like generals like Jackson will have a tactical value that they'll always add to combat. That's then compared against the enemy general's tactical value. So he could get further pluses based on his own tactical value. And then they also have a command stat that affects their ability to successfully initiate large assaults. Because when you want to initiate assault, you have to roll a d6 to see if the assault actually goes off. And if everyone you're trying to get to do the assault goes. Which I like. That's actually a cool system. Because that is a huge problem in these battles, is that you're like, okay, we're assaulting this hill at 8 a.m. and you attack, and the other division's like, oh, you're 8 a.m. Oh shit, we're still having breakfast. Like, well, that attack didn't work. So that modeling that element is interesting, but then that's another stat that generals have. So like Stonewall Jackson has an amazing value for initiating assaults versus other generals. So there's these other factors that also contribute to how good a general is. And then on top of that, you have this, in the core rules, it's Jackson, Longstreet only from 1864 for some reason, which I feel like is a balanced choice that I do not understand, that just like only once Jackson's dead.
Yeah.
And Lee all the time, any general he's stacked with gets the bonus because Lee's an army general, so he works a little bit differently. And then in certain entries, other generals would get bonuses as well. There weren't any in Stonewall Jackson's way because Stonewall Jackson is the protagonist, so he's already got one. But if you play like Hood Strikes North, I think Hood has one. And some of the other battles, like where other generals are involved. And there's very few for the Union. I think I found in one of the games, maybe Battle of the Clouds, which is Chickamauga, I think Thomas gets a plus one whenever he's defending because he's the Rock of Chickamauga. And then I think there might be one other bonus to another Union general, but it's a huge disparity. Way more Confederates have bonuses than Union generals.
And that sort of giving Thomas that bonus in Above the Clouds, that feels like cute little historical chrome because he did amazingly in that battle, whereas giving it sort of pretty much flatly across the board to the Confederates is less cute little historical chrome, and it's a balance sort of decision. It's an active decision. I mean, back to the movement as well, this whole game, it's operational. Movement is the name of the game. You know, you can beat, we didn't do this, but I'm sure you can win the scenario having maybe like less than a handful of battles, you know, if you're managing your movement well, if you're managing your fatigue well, and really getting around the side of people. And being able to have my minimum move as a single Confederate unit be one, and the Confederate minimum move be double that, you know, be two, that's really impactful. That's really, really impactful. And can really change the tide a lot of the times.
And yet Stuart still won.
You feel better. You feel better being the Confederates. Like it's just like, you feel more powerful.
But the Confederates lost against me in the last round, in the main campaign. And that was...
Confederates lost every game we played.
Yep. Yeah, they did.
It is very balanced.
Again, that's balanced. But, like, why give them the bonus? Just check the balance differently.
And it's weird, again, that it's a system rule. Because, like, in Stonewall in the Valley, Confederates getting plus one feels appropriate. Because that's a campaign that was defined by the Confederates knowing the terrain better and marching faster the whole time. And constantly being able to push... Jack's being able to push his units faster and harder and knowing where they were going better. So that's one where it really makes sense. But it's just like every battle you get it. You get it in like, you know, the 1864 Western campaigns. And it's like, why do you have it here? This doesn't make sense. And yeah, it's a really weird.
It's really weird. It feels really weird. It feels weird. And it feels so obviously weird as well. Yeah. Like it's in your face.
A little like it's the similar kind of vibe to that kind of classic. You know, any Reb can whip 10 Yankees.
Yeah.
Just got that, like, sense of their superiority as a fighting unit.
And it's a given. Then, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, that they're just that little bit better. Than
across the board.
They're a little bit more competent. That little, just around, like, and it feeds into that kind of lost cause feeling of the Confederacy. We're better soldiers, better generals, better fighting force that were defeated by superior numbers and superior, like, industrial supply and capacity. Is like a really core lost cause myth that is just not true.
But still, overall, GCACW, you've enjoyed your time with it, and I guess you'd want to play other games in the system.
Absolutely, for me, yeah, definitely. I want to get my teeth in it. I want to play it at a convention to try out a big physical game of it. That being said, I also want to try different entries just online. It's really fun. It's just a really fun turn-to-turn game to play. And it's really, it knows exactly what it wants to do. And it does that perfectly in my mind. It's impressive, I think, with how it all comes together.
I like it. I definitely like it. I think victory conditions are the single greatest barrier to me really loving it. They really kind of suck it out of me. But this is the thing, like, I think I feel this like I did with Longstreet Attacks, in that I really liked Blind Swords as a system. I had a really good time with it. And I wasn't really in love with Longstreet Attacks. A lot of it similarly, like, I didn't love the victory conditions and the kind of narrative specifically it told. And I went and tried other Blind Swords games, and I found quite a few that I really like. And that's been great. And I feel like that's probably a chance for that for GCACW, except there's that, like, when I went and tried other Blind Swords games, they cost me, like, $40. Yeah. When I want to try other GCACW games, it's like, ooh. But I'm looking at maybe getting Hood Strikes North, because it's a one mapper, and getting some of those side, like, fan-made side displays, or even just making some hideous ones of my own. Because I think I can fit one map and some displays on my table and trying it solitaire. Because I think when I'm playing a game solo, I give far fewer fucks about the victory conditions as written.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm happy to just, like, vibe it and see how the narrative, and, like, yeah. And then kind of judge at the end how I feel it went. So I think that's an interesting way I want to explore the system. And I would actually really like to play the Valley campaign at some point. I want to try it. That huge campaign, and Stonewall in the Valley is three maps. It's more maps than any of those era was. So it's this huge map of the Valley. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It's so cool. I mean, the maps, they just bring you in. I love the maps. I mean, this one, I love on your turns, I would just look around and I'd find, like, funny little place names and things. And it's great. I've actually got a list here of the funniest ones I found.
Go ahead.
you indulge me. There's Shatwell's Mount. Yeah. There's Muddy Run Mount. Naked Mount, the Blue Ball. That's another mountain.
The Blue Ball.
Yeah, yeah. Steptoe Mount. It's great. I love these names.
You can just space out while the other player.
You can, and it's the same as the Library of Napoleonic Battles. That's why I love those. You can just get lost in that little in the map and really, like, build it. It just all adds to that narrative that you want to tell, and it's so effective, I think.
Yeah, to credit, Charlie Kibler does the maps for these, and I think Charlie Kibler, I don't actually know if this is heresy, but I think I like Charlie Kibler more than I like Rick Barber.
Yeah, same. Easy.
Oh, I don't know. I really like to get lost in a Rick Barber map. And
Rick
you do
Barber's
get lost in them. They're beautiful, but they're beautiful. I mean, it's a tough call. But they're both good.
It's definitely a tough call. They're both great, but I think I agree. So I prefer these Kibler maps to Rick Barber.
So before we get any angry emails, what are we doing next, guys? let's stop this. This is. I'm cutting short this conversation.
Decision.
Sorry. No. Okay, so Rick Barber, much better. All right. And then what are we playing? What are we doing next?
Oh, actually, the next game we're going to play is a Rick Barber map.
Nice, so it's like amazing. A transition. Great.
It was all planned.
We're just going to shit on that the whole time, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be really rude about it. We're going to play Fire on the Mountain, which is a John Poniski design. It came out in 2022 from Legion Wargames. It's the Battle of South Mountain, which is kind of the first big engagement of the Maryland campaign, which is the campaign that then immediately follows on and will climax at the Battle of Antietam.
Yeah.
So this is South Mountain. It looks like it's a hex encounter tactical game. It's got a really nice Rick Barber map, and it hasn't gotten a lot of coverage. I feel like there was good coverage when it came out and then not a lot of buzz afterwards, so I'm really keen to try this one. I haven't played any John Poniski games before.
Neither have I.
Yeah. They always have something interesting. The rules are sometimes a little hard to deal with at first, but there's always something in a Poniski design.
I'm really excited for it. I've heard that a lot.
This looks like a more traditional game than some of the Poniski games that I've played, but still, I mean, he's really an interesting designer, and I'm sure you'll have fun, especially playing on that beautiful, beautiful Rick Barber map.
We'll give you the full review next time.
Yeah.
But I love this because the Maryland is actually on the northeast of of this game's map. So we'll really get that sort of follow on from now.
I like how you can actually stick a lot of the GCACW maps together most of a map of Virginia out of it.
You should be working on your version of the all of the war on a single 10
it's a
10 mapper.
It's an 800 turn.
There is a scenario for you can do the Peninsula campaign and the Valley campaign next to each other, and it's six maps. Seven maps, and it's 150 turns or something insane.
It's five European.
You buy a house. You dedicate the house to this project.
You have
yours.
To rent
it's,
another
it's a project.
Flat for it.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, as we are planning out the economics of that project,
you have to buy the games first. Yeah,
Stuart Pierre, thanks again. yeah, absolutely. It's more expensive than the house. Actually, the house is the easy part.
Set up a Ko-fi for a game fund and for renting a studio.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for the conversation, guys, and thank you everyone for listening to this episode of We Intend to Move on Your Works. We hope to see you next time, and until then, happy gaming.
Rebel boy, born on the banks of the Shenandoah. In 61 I went to the war to win one for Virginia. Yeah, my brother went first and they called me too. I was green as clover in the morning dew. So I marched to the drum and I sang to the tune. Carry me back to Virginia. Fire in the cannon, water in the well. Raced through the valley with a rebel yell. I learned right quick how to march like hell and to fix that bayonet. Saddle, powder in the gun. We thought for a minute our fight was done. So they lined us up with the medals on and hammered us into the quicksand. Then they burned that valley with a blaze of fire. Cut through the lines like a red hot iron. So we ran full cover with the horses piled. And we shivered in the cold against them. But the war edged on like flames of hail. We dug from the pockets of the ones that fell. Dressed in rags and we ate like rats. When they cut off our legs we cried. Won't you carry me back? Won't you carry me back? Carry me back to Virginia. Virginia. Swamp on the banks of the river where the whitetail jumps. Dad in the ditches, dad in the field, in the belly of the wagon for a wounds for him. Dad in the wards, starved in the camps, locked in the prisons, old mean and ranks, spilled our blood in the fight to defend and the buried us all over Dixieland.